We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Examining Education. I'm Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. Today's program looks at the current state of teacher tenure. As state budgets shrink, education reform has come to the forefront, and many feel that teacher tenure has come under attack. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, for example, has been particularly outspoken, claiming that the time to end tenure is now, and he's happy to have New Jersey lead the way. States with movements to eliminate tenure also include Florida, Idaho, Illinois, Ohio, New York, and Pennsylvania. The Illinois legislature, for example, with the support of the two teacher unions, passed a bill in the spring of 2011 that included some changes to tenure. Instead of automatically getting tenure after 4 years, teachers will need to meet a particular set of performance goals. Layoffs and rehirings will not be determined solely by seniority, but be partially based on performance evaluations. In addition, the process for dismissing unsatisfactory teachers has been streamlined. Our first guest has some historical background on how teacher tenure came to be. Kate Rumanier is professor and chair in the Department of Educational Leadership at Miami University, Ohio. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Can you tell us a little about your interest in the history of teaching and teachers' unions?
Sure. I was a social studies high school teacher for a couple of years before I got my doctorate, and I learned that I think a lot of teachers learn, which is that a large part of the job, of course, has to do with educating children and getting to know children and developing curriculum. But there's another part of the job that parents and community members may not see, which is working in an organization. It's very important that teachers work and learn how to work together, that they learn how to work with their administrators, that teachers have a participation and a feeling of some kind of meaning and active involvement in creating curriculum and educational policy. And so there's this kind of day-to-day organizational life of teachers that a lot of the public does not see, and that I found very, very interesting when I was a teacher. And as I was a trained historian, I took that to graduate school and began to write about the history of teacher organization in many senses. And part of that, but not all of it, involved thinking about teacher unions and the history of teacher unions, how teachers developed as a profession, how they developed as an organizational unit. And part of that has to do with how they then also developed teacher unions to help advocate for and protect their interests and also the interests of the children who they were teaching.
Well, can you tell us something about the history of tenure policies?
Yeah. Tenure's a really interesting case in a lot of ways. I know people have a lot of assumptions about what teacher tenure policies are about. But there are really two key elements for the rationale for teacher tenure. And one of them is the issue of academic freedom, and the other is the goal of creating a stable and qualified workforce. And I want to talk about the second one first. Because it's really sort of the most surprising to me as I've been doing research in this area. Up until about the late 19th century, American schools were locally organized and founded, as they continue to be today, and there was essentially no teacher professional organization in any way. Teachers were hired for any reason and fired for any reason by the local school boards. There were very few qualifications for becoming a teacher and very few qualifications for firing a teacher, so there was no standards in any sense in the profession. This was a problem to a lot of educators. It led to a really high turnover rate for teachers. Many teachers would come into the field on their way to another profession or on their way to starting a family. People didn't exactly know what they were doing as teachers. There was no common curriculum for teachers to follow. And the other problem that was quite prominent was that many of these new teachers were women. I say that's a problem because it's not a problem to me, but to late 19th century educational professionals, they saw a profession that they wanted to create, and they saw this dominance of women, about three-quarters of all teachers were women in this time period, as being something that was undermining their goal of professionalizing the field. So there's a low status in education and no standards, no qualifications. So what happened is, in the late 19th, early 20th century, professional educators wanted to develop teaching as a profession, and one of the ways they wanted to do that was to improve the working conditions of teachers by providing pensions, salary scale, and teacher tenure. Now, this is surprising because most people think that teacher unions advocated for these causes originally, but it was administrators, it was state and local administrators who saw a problem with the teaching force, and they wanted to make it a better profession. They wanted to make it a better job. They ultimately saw that providing these benefits would also essentially make the whole education profession more efficient, because turnover is very expensive, training unqualified teachers is very expensive, and if you can get a stable workforce, then you can develop a profession and actually keep some kind of consistency in the occupation. That's really one of the most, to me, interesting things about the development of tenure. It came along with a whole movement to also improve education that led to the creation of teacher education schools and curriculum standards and standards in school buildings and other educational policies. So it was part of a whole package of educational change in the late 19th and early 20th century. So that was the first motivation, historical motivation for tenure, the creation of a stable and qualified workforce. I'd like to add that part of the way that tenure was created to support a stable and professional workforce was that tenure was designed as a property right authorized by the state and conferred by the district. So it seems like somewhat an obscure issue, but in fact it was state legislatures that determined the basis for tenure and eligibility requirements and procedures. It was part of an overall development of civil service employment in the late 19th and early 20th century, in which the state set up legislation that required of school districts and other public employees a very clear personnel employment policy that would include, for example, a required probationary period, qualifications, and a notice of dismissal and just cause. So these policies were set up before unions came in and also adopted those kinds of policies. These were the kinds of procedures that state legislators set up because they wanted to further this efficient and well-organized educational system.
Let me just interrupt that. Actually, this is interesting because right now it's state legislatures that are talking about removing tenure. And I had thought, since I thought it was a union issue, now it makes more sense.
Yeah. And that's interesting, too, because one of the motivations of state legislators in this early period was that local school boards were also considered a problem. School boards are locally elected citizens. They may or may not have an education background. They may or may not have any understanding of education as a profession. They may be in a position where they are acting, hiring relatives, hiring friends. This is in the past. We hope not today. And so some of these part of this legislative motivation was to try to control school boards, essentially professionals in state houses saying, these local educators in overalls who are running our schools really don't know what they're doing, and so we need to provide a kind of guideline for them. So, yes, it's very ironic that state legislators are now trying to pull away from this again and give it back to the local. Education is always torn in this tension between the local and the state. We are local organizations by the Constitution, by American law, and yet there is always this tension to have some kind of state regulation because the local does not always work fairly. It does not always provide equity to all players.
Were there any states that took the lead in developing good working conditions?
There were a number of states that started off developing tenure. The first state policy was in New Jersey in 1909. The next state was Ohio in 1910 and Oregon in 1913. They were mostly cities and cities in those large cities and then those states which developed policies. So by 1956, about 20 states had tenure laws and also a number of large cities. So Chicago, New York, and other major cities had tenure laws, as well as pensions and other welfare benefits for teachers. And a lot of that was because in those cities there were strong teacher associations at that time. They were not yet formally unions because teachers did not get collective bargaining rights until the early 60s. But they were powerful teacher associations that lobbied their city and state legislators. And so that's where the tenure laws developed.
And again, what's interesting is you said New Jersey began, was the first leader in developing tenure, and now apparently it wants to be the leader in removing tenure.
I wish that people in New Jersey would read their history books a little bit more and maybe get a better understanding of why they originally developed tenure.
Uh-huh.
I haven't heard in any of the discussions about getting rid of tenure what the original impetus for it was. The second rationale for tenure has to do with academic freedom. The argument behind academic freedom for teachers is that teachers should be free to teach unpopular or controversial topics without worrying about losing their jobs. And they should also be free to use innovative teaching methods and not risk losing their jobs because it upsets some people. They should be free to assess a student in the way that they think is appropriate and not fear that the parent is going to put pressure on the principal and have them lose their job. The most famous case of academic freedom is the Scopes trial in 1925, when a Tennessee biology teacher was found guilty of breaking the state law because he taught evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of people think that that case is old and never happens today, but in fact, there are continue to be cases of teachers. In fact, I've just read about a teacher in Indiana, a middle school teacher in Indiana, who during a lesson from a student on current events was asked by the student if she supported the Iraq War, and when she said she did not support the Iraq War, parents heard about the discussion and complained, and the school district refused to renew the teacher's contract. So there are very current issues in this. My other favorite example about tenure is that teachers should be free to be one person's favorite teacher and not another person's favorite teacher. What I mean by that is we all remember a teacher who we loved, and inevitably we had a classmate who did not like that teacher. So if the classmate who doesn't like the teacher has some sort of power in the school district, then they can get rid of that teacher, and even though another student really liked the teacher. Teaching is an art as much as it is a science, and so people have different impressions and experiences with teachers. And that's one of the reasons teachers really have to be protected, because it's that real, the depth and complexity of the fabric of teaching that makes it a position that needs to be protected for academic freedom within the classroom.
Any guesses about why these same factors, attracting a stable workforce and protecting academic freedom, may not seem so important today?
I don't believe that the public think there is an academic freedom issue with teachers, given that there are increasing standardized curriculum and standardized policies. I also think, sadly, that the public still believes that anybody can become a teacher,
mm-hmm.
and that in this, the teaching profession may have failed, because it is still common thought amongst a lot of people that someone can go to school during the summer and become a teacher in the fall. They don't think the same of doctors. They would not feel secure working with a doctor who went to summer training to learn how to become a doctor or to become a lawyer. But there is still a sense that teaching is something that just anybody can do. I believe that the breaking apart of the public school system with new opportunities for charter schools has probably furthered that belief, because in the charter school movement, individual communities and individuals can create schools and hire teachers who may or may not have formal qualifications. And people think that's a good idea, and they don't follow up and see what happens to those teachers and to those students who have been trained by teachers who have been taught by teachers who do not have good training.
Well, what do you imagine will be the future of tenure for K through 12 teachers in the U.S.?
I want to think very positively. I want to think that the argument will be made to keep tenure for teachers for a number of reasons, for the reasons of developing a stable and professional workforce and attracting qualified teachers to the profession, and not only for a few years. Part of the issue with creating a stable workforce is to prevent turnover. And right now, 50% of all teachers leave within the first 5 years. That's 50% of all teachers leave. And so we need to develop a kind of profession where we have long-term stable teachers working in an environment that they want to continue to work in. And so I think that once people begin to understand that tenure actually will save money in that respect, because we won't be having to continually train and hire new teachers, that will further the argument for tenure. And also, I believe that people will learn that teachers with tenure do improve schooling. They're experienced teachers. They've been around. They know what works for kids. And experience matters. Experience matters in all the professions we know of, and it should also matter and does matter for teachers.
We've been talking to Kate Rumanier, professor and chair of educational leadership at Miami University, Ohio. Our topic today is reforming teacher tenure. In a moment, we'll speak with Rick Hess, someone who not only wants to change tenure policies, but would also like to see schools change the way they're staffed. I'm Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley, and this is Examining Education. This is Examining Education. I'm your host and producer, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley. We've been talking about teacher tenure and ways to reform it. My next guest is Frederick Hess, resident scholar and director of education policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Let's begin this part of the program by having you tell us a little about the Institute and your own experience with the issue of tenure.
Sure. I got started in education about 20-odd years ago, went to graduate school in education at Harvard University out of college, taught high school down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, got a little frustrated by the nature of the work environment, went back, got my PhD and taught at a college of education. So most of, most of my engagement with questions of tenure have been as a scholar and an academic. I came to AEI in 2002. I'm a director of education policy studies here. And, you know, one of the questions I spend a fair bit of time on is teacher quality and the nature of what teachers do. And it's hard to talk about that without engaging in discussion about tenure.
So what do you see as the problems with the current situation?
I think the real problem is we've got a teaching profession which was perfectly reasonably designed for the middle of the 19th century when educated women had few options other than to enter the teaching profession. As late as the 1950s, 55% of college-educated women became teachers. And we could therefore kind of depend on a steady stream of talent coming in and teaching for 30 years. And in fact, at a time in the early 20th century, when teachers were capriciously and cavalierly fired because they got pregnant, because they didn't fit, conform to height weight charts, because they were suspected of being communist sympathizers, tenure was probably a sensible protection. The problem is we're now in a world where we can no longer count on a steady inflow of quality candidates into teaching in the traditional manner, where few people enter a profession and choose to do the job for 25 or 30 years. And therefore, it seems to me only sensible to start to retool the nature of the work so that we are getting as much value as possible out of the most effective educators and creating room in the profession to make uses of other kind of talent. All of this is enormously difficult when people start to hold their job as an entitlement after a few years of adequate performance.
Well, what reforms would you want to propose?
I think, you know, we've got 3.4 million teachers in the U.S. today. That's more than one out of every 10 college-educated adults in the workforce. It's incredibly difficult to think about having, you know, about finding that many talented people or improving folks through professional development, which is typically uncertain in its benefits. So the first thing is to say, how do we actually build a profession where we don't need 3.4 million people to be great, but where the 5 or 10 terrific teachers in a school are actually in a position to carry a much heavier share of the load and to be recognized and compensated accordingly, and where we start to think about other teachers working side by side with them in other kinds of roles as supportive, as complementary, and where we start to use new technologies, whether online learning or computer-assisted learning, to handle some of the rote or more routine instructional tasks that aren't necessarily the great use of a highly skilled professional's time.
Well, tell me, then that sounds like tiers or like teacher aides at different levels?
I think there's any number of ways to think about it. You know, we talk about often about the need to turn around, persistently low-performing schools. Most principals of my acquaintance would say, look, the challenge one in that school environment is to get your kids reading at grade level. If you don't get them reading at grade level, nothing else is going to work. If you do that, you got a fighting chance. That suggests to me that in, say, a K-5 elementary school, you really need, more than anything else, 6 phenomenal English language arts instructors. Unfortunately, when you have 4 or 5 teachers at a grade level teaching it, we know for a fact that you're going to have a real hard time making sure they're all good. Mm-hmm. So in a school of 40 teachers, if your recipe starts by, okay, first get 40 good teachers, that's a pretty high bar. If you start thinking about reallocating the work that's being done, so one teacher at each grade level, for instance, becomes the go-to teacher for ELA, for English Language Arts, I think it becomes a much more manageable proposition to think about those 6 teachers as the backbone of that school's instructional team. But then we want to think about compensating them and evaluating them and recognizing them accordingly. And this starts to require that we think very differently about the job and the pay and the job security of both them and their colleagues.
But wouldn't these kind of master teachers still have things like tenure and seniority or what?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think the reality is that if you start to organize a profession so that when we have highly skilled professionals, we're trying to get the most use out of them, what we're going to move into is a new set of arrangements, which I think you're right, are going to have absolutely going to have room for seniority. There's going to be an appropriate place for people who are going to commit to the organization for the long term and who are going to want some assurance in turn. But what's interesting is things like the step-in-lane pay scale, which is an artifact from, the first decade of the 20th century, teacher tenure policies as they exist. It's not that these ideas are necessarily bad ideas, but they have become so rigidified and so restrictive over time that they make it very difficult for us to start thinking about retooling and reshaping how we actually deliver high-quality instruction.
Mostly it sounds as though you're defining different, having different levels of teaching so that you have, as I said, master teachers, supportive teachers, teachers' aides. And I'm not sure how this connects to the issue of tenure.
Well, I mean, part of the problem with tenure is a recipe for a one-size-fits-all job. What we say is we've got 3.4 million teachers, and they're either tenured or they're not. And if they're tenured, they now have a property right to their position. And if we want to move them from their current position, we are highly restricted as to how and where we might be able to move them. And mm-hmm. we certainly cannot remove them even if they are turning in mediocre performance.
So one of the problems, of course, is identifying who would be these teachers, the master teachers who would be teachers' aides? Would that be one of the problems?
Oh, sure. What we're talking about here is thinking very differently about how do we staff schools and use talent. And there's any number of problems. any organization, we look at newspapers that have gone through dramatic transitions. We look at General Motors, which we all now own, which we kind of generously helped through its travails. Any organization that's trying to shift from one way of doing business to another way of doing business is absolutely going to have to wrestle with any number of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
The trick with tenure is that it makes it very difficult for superintendents or principals to do so, because what tenure stipulates is that these teachers, once they have done their, depending on the state law in question, their 3 years or their 5 years of teaching, essentially have a property right to their job, and it becomes exquisitely difficult and exquisitely expensive to try to remove these folks from their position, making it incredibly difficult to rethink how do we staff schools, making it enormously difficult to remove low performers, and at the end of the day, creating just an enormous roadblock to superintendents or school leaders who are trying to rethink the way that they use talent in their schools and buildings.
What do you think about the fear that teachers have that if tenure and seniority rules disappear, management would force more senior teachers to leave in favor of cheaper teachers?
I think these kinds of concerns are hardly unique to education. We have laws about age discrimination on the books. So if management is truly terminating teachers for nothing other than this, then there of course is recourse. But honestly, if I'm thinking about this not from what a teacher feels entitled to, but in terms of ensuring that limited school dollars are spent to best serve kids, if one teacher is making $55,000 or $75,000 and another teacher is teaching $40,000 or $45,000, and the principal responsible for that building thinks they are equally effective when it comes to educating, serving, and mentoring children, it strikes me that just like in any business, we want to encourage management to be thoughtful about making sure that it's spending dollars in ways that furthers the organizational mission. I think I'd rather have a school district spending the dollars on a teacher who is equally good but less expensive and spending those other dollars to make sure that kids are being well served.
Well, I know that you think some states have approached reforming tenure and teachers' conditions of employment more productively than others. Can you elaborate on your comparisons?
Sure. I think one of the challenges is because superintendents and school boards and principals have done an irresponsible job when it comes to evaluating teachers, which is why we see in district after district in reports such as the New Teacher Project's The Widget Effect, we see 99% of teachers rated as satisfactory. That is a failure of management to actually evaluate employees in a responsible way. We often scapegoat teacher unions, but that's really unfair to the unions. Management's job is to make sure they're evaluating employees with the evaluation systems. Because management has been so irresponsible on this score, reformers are hesitant to trust much to the judgment of superintendents or principals. So what we're seeing written into state law in states like Colorado, Florida, and elsewhere are statutes that set out new guidelines regarding teacher tenure, in which a substantial part is going to be based on student value-added scores on reading and math state assessments.
Mm-hmm.
The logic of this makes sense, that if districts are not going to evaluate teachers responsibly, that it's important to ensure that teachers are being evaluated in some kind of reasonable and relatively objective fashion. The problem is I'm relatively unconvinced that today's reading and math of value-added scores, much less tests we're going to devise in other subjects, are necessarily a particularly terrific measure of teacher quality. I think they certainly tell us something, and it's useful information, but I hesitate to lay too much weight on it. So for me, the states that I think are moving most, you know, in a way that we're going to ultimately regard as kind of most useful, is a state like Colorado, where there is, I think, a healthy balance in which districts are being pushed to focus on student achievement over the course of the year, but that's only going to be a component of what they're doing, along with other metrics that districts are being pushed to devise. I think the states where I am most concerned about is where too much weight is resting on simple calculations of student value added on reading and math scores in that teacher's classroom.
Uh-huh. Any states that you'd point to that?
Actually, it's interesting. There's a number of states that are clustered at stipulating that 50% of a teacher evaluation for purposes of tenure is going to be student value added on those reading and math assessments, or analogous metrics for the three-quarters of teachers for whom you can't generate such calculations. I'm sympathetic to why the states have gone there. I think it's, you know, a reasonable step from where we've been, but I am concerned that it's not the most sensible way to go about trying to sort out who might deserve tenure and who doesn't.
Are there any model arrangements that you could point to, say, internationally?
No, I think there's this quick tendency for people who have a point to score to start talking about Finland or Singapore because they're doing what these people happen to think is good policy. But when interpreting international performance, particularly in nations, you know, like Finland or Singapore, which, you know, are about the size of Nebraska or Minnesota, which have very different educational challenges and exist in very different sociocultural contexts, I think it's incredibly important to be careful about kind of cherry-picking things we like and saying these are the right ways to go.
What about the role of the AFT? What do you think of their proposals for reform?
I think that there's incremental steps that that the AFT has taken, which are moving, like I said, incrementally in the right direction. But look, I think there's two very different perspectives on teacher tenure. If you're a teacher or you're a member, or you're a leader in a teacher union, you think that this is something that is part of the rules of the road, that if you play fair, you deserve tenure, or your members deserve tenure. And teachers may disagree on various things, but for the most part, especially veteran teachers, are going to agree that they think tenure is a good thing. On the other hand, it's actually different. National Center for Educational Information did a survey earlier this year, and among teachers who've been teaching 5 years or less, 47% actually support getting rid of tenure. So there is a degree of variation within the teacher workforce, partly depending on how long teachers have been teaching.
I'm
completely sympathetic to the notion that the AFT, at the end of the day, thinks tenure is a good and reasonable thing, and it would be. If any of us would like to have a sinecure in our job and be guaranteed that we're taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, as somebody who's looking from outside, if we're thinking about how do we make sure we are getting our best teachers in front of our kids, that we are spending limited dollars as wisely as possible to educate our kids, I think the case for tenure in any form today is relatively weak. Tenure was an artifact of a time before there were civil service laws, before teachers enjoyed the same non-discrimination protections as any other public employee. And I think what it does today is it creates a relatively destructive and generally unnecessary level of insulation, which doesn't do that much to protect good educators, but which makes it enormously difficult and time-consuming to try to remove ineffective educators.
We've been talking to Rick Hess, resident scholar and director of education policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Our topic today is reforming teacher tenure. Coming up next, we find out what the American Federation of Teachers thinks about reforming tenure. This is Examining Education. This is Examining Education. I'm your host and producer, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. We've been talking about teacher tenure and ways to reform it. My next guest is Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. Let's begin this part of the program by having you tell us a little about the AFT and your own involvement with reforming tenure.
The AFT is both an education organization as well as a labor union. We represent about 1.5 million people, hardworking people from pre-kindergarten through 12th grade, teachers, paraprofessionals, and then we also represent higher education faculty and staff, nurses, other healthcare workers, and other state and local employees. And frankly, we have always thought that tenure should be about due process. And I have started trying to do things around the issue of tenure, making sure that the hearings were fair and fast. Back from, I would say, before I was president of the Teachers Union in New York City, the first contract in which we negotiated reforms to the due process system was in 1987.
Could you clarify the role of unions versus state legislature versus the local school district in negotiations about tenure?
So the unions actually have the least role and yet get the most finger-pointing when it comes to the issue of due process and tenure. What tenure was for school teachers around the country, and whether it was by statute or whether it was by contract or whether it was by constitution, is that teachers used to be fired for any reason or no reason at all. If they were pregnant and a school community thought that that didn't sit well with the community, teachers would be fired. If they were part of the wrong political party and a new political party was elected, they would be fired. So back, you know, for 100 years, there were these rules that say, before you get fired, there has to be a good reason. And that was the origin of tenure in public school systems, to ensure that it was about what you knew in terms of having a job, not who you knew. And so, you know, some contracts have these kind of tenure proceedings. Sometimes it's state legislatures. So what the unions would do would just make sure that this was fair and that it was fair as applied to individual teachers. And then because of the duty of fair representation, what happens is that if somebody is brought up on charges or disciplined or whatever, a union doesn't get a choice to say, oh, I'm going to defend this person, but I'm not going to defend this person. And so the unions would defend people in these fairness proceedings or in these due process proceedings. The people who actually created the tenure laws were state legislators or in contracts, mostly state legislatures, to stop cronyism and corruption and this arbitrariness. And the people who actually gave tenure, meaning that after a probationary period, they were told that they were going to be a permanent employee and therefore had a due process hearing before they were fired, those are always the managers. What our union has done in the last 2-3 years is to say, wait a second, we want to take more control over the situation. We want to be more involved because this is now much more about teacher quality than almost about anything else. And so what we've tried to do is say, let's have a real evaluation system, not have the tenure process become the evaluation system. That's number one. Let's really do a real, thorough, ongoing evaluation of teachers. And then let's make sure that we help teachers if they, you know, don't do well in the evaluation. And then have a quick process so that the process itself can't be used as a shield in incompetence or as an excuse for managers not to manage.
What kind of changes in the procedure would you like?
So what we've done over the course of time, meaning the last 2 years, is we've, number one, said that the procedure itself should not be the evaluation. That's one of the reasons that it takes so long to have some of these tenure proceedings, because what happens is that there's no evaluation of teachers, and then somebody wakes up one day and says, this person really can't do what he or she should be is supposed to be doing. And then the procedure itself becomes like the evaluation. So we've said, no, there should be a real evaluation of a teacher, and that this should be an embedded process of every school system, where evaluation is about continuous improvement. And if somebody's not, you know, continually doing what they're supposed to do or improving, then, you know, there's an issue. And then the second thing we said is, let's make sure that there's a real rehabilitation process. That's a big change. That's something that some you know, districts do around the country. That's something that other districts don't do. But you give somebody a real evaluation in terms of an assessment of their performance, and if their performance is not up to snuff, you help them. And then what happens is you can make these procedures much quicker. Another change we've proposed is that, you know, before somebody is offered a permanent job, meaning has passed their probation, would make sure that somebody really knows what they're doing. And that also is something that can happen within an evaluation process. And the third piece that we've said is that in situations where people are accused of are alleged to do some wrong act, some misconduct, we ask Ken Feinberg to help us figure out how to really make the process both fair and fast. And Feinberg is someone who has been known around the country to really help solve some of the most vexing, you know, problems that people have had. He was the magistrate during the, you know, for all the claims in terms of 9/11. He's been the magistrate for claims in terms of BP after the spill last year. So we asked him to help us, and what he did last February is he created a framework, it created a way, and made a proposal that it would take no more than 100 days from the time a teacher was charged to the time a hearing was not just completed, but a decision was made whether to keep a teacher or to remove a teacher. And so we've adopted that procedure as well.
Well, now let me just ask you to clarify about the termination. Then you're saying at any point, a teacher could have been teaching for 10 years, 20 years, but at that point, if there are complaints, that there would be this process that would be gone through to see if those complaints were legitimate.
Right, because what happens is that teachers normally, in the United States of America, teachers don't have a due process hearing, which is tenure in K through 12. It's different than higher education tenure. So tenure is really just a hearing. Teachers don't have that until they've passed their probationary period. In some school districts, that's 2 years. In some school districts, that's 3 years. In other districts, that's 4 or 5 years. So they actually don't even get a hearing until they pass their probationary period. And so once they have that hearing, what happens is they can't be fired before somebody says, is there reasons for them to be fired? And normally, the reason that these hearings went on so long is because there hasn't been an evaluation. Mm-hmm. So what would happen is somebody says, oh, you know, Randy is no longer doing a good job. Something happened. This year there's a lot of complaints. She's not doing a good job. Have we actually ever evaluated Randy? Maybe not. Maybe once, you know, 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So then what has happened is that the tenure hearing before the judge or the arbitrator became the evaluation. Now, that's ridiculous. So mm-hmm. we should have ongoing evaluations of teachers.
So what would be involved in these evaluations?
Well, we're actually, the AFT has actually proposed an evaluation template and framework, which we proposed in January 2010, adopted as policy in July 2010, and frankly, we are now working with the American Association of School Administrators around that framework. And what it involves is, in layperson's terms, what am I teaching? Am I doing what I say I'm going to do as a school teacher? And then secondly, are the kids learning? So it's about teacher practice, and it's about student learning. And there's a lot of different ways that you measure that. So we, in our lexicon, we always call this multiple measures. meaning let's look at several different aspects to judge, to evaluate whether someone is doing the job that we have asked them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And because kids are different and classes are different, and, you know, so for example, I may, in a class that I taught as a high school social studies teacher, say I was teaching about the branches of government, and one day, one year, that course went incredibly well, and my kids really got that the executive branch, you know, where, you know, say maybe it was the year that President Obama was elected, so that they were following it, and they really got that the president has certain powers and the Congress has other powers. But maybe it was a year, because I taught in New York City, that President Bush was president.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't really, that in that class itself, I wasn't connecting to kids. The same examples I was giving the year after that went so well, went so poorly the year before.
Right,
now,
so class is very
fun. Right, so this is why this is complicated. So does that mean that one year, because that particular class, which somebody was observing, it was popping. People were answering questions. Everybody's hand was in the air. People knew President Obama was just elected president because, you know, they were involved in it. They were engaged in it. And another year, maybe they weren't. And so that's part of, it's a matter of, what is my practice? Am I asking good questions? Am I trying to get the information across? Has the homework aligned with the work that I'm trying to do in class? That's what an observation is about. And second, though, is have kids learned it? Have you connected with kids? Is there and if they haven't, are you creating a different kind of plan in order to see if we can help make sure that kids learn? But we're not totally responsible for everything that happens to kids, so that piece of it is a part of an evaluation, but can't be a big part of it. But the American Federation of Teachers is working with about 100 of our locals and management and other places to really try to create holistic, meaningful, comprehensive evaluation systems that also embed in them the whole process of continuous improvement of quality so that new teachers become good teachers become great teachers, and then when somebody flounders, after you give them help, if you really tried to help them and they're still floundering, then you have a quick process that says that separates them out from the profession.
Well, let me just ask you, are there any states that you would point to as models of what you would like?
Well, there's some, so for example, there's some districts like New Haven, Connecticut, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Hillsborough, Florida, Douglas County, Colorado, New York and Rhode Island have approved together, have done together some kind of evaluation model as well. There's different places in the country that are doing this the right way. Then there's a whole bunch of places like Ohio and Florida and Wisconsin who tried to do this the wrong way. Basically, just have tried to, in the guise of pretending they were about student achievement and growth and opportunity, basically cut budgets and strip teachers of voice. And so, you know, so there's a lot of states that are trying to, you know, there were a lot of states that were trying to change their evaluation systems. The reason that I hesitate in answering about states is because mm-hmm. in state after state after state right now, we're seeing huge budget cuts. So it's hard to actually do the change our education systems to become knowledge-based systems as opposed to memorization-based systems at
right.
the very same time as you've had these tremendous budget cuts, which deeply affect particularly kids at risk.
Do you think that financially strapped districts or states should have some flexibility in picking less expensive but highly rated teachers?
Well, the question is that there's a presumption in the question that less expensive equals better, and frankly, there's no other profession where we actually don't value experience. Experience actually creates judgment. You need to have a balance in education. You want the exuberance of youth, and you want the sagaciousness of experience.
What do you see in the future in terms of teacher employment and tenure?
Well, what I see is that teachers need to be treated fairly. They want to make a difference in the lives of kids. And a lot of what they have to do based upon their own moxie. And so we know that teachers need more training and ongoing training to be facile in all the new things that they have to learn. We know that kids need more than their individual attention of teacher. We know that we know that teachers try to differentiate to the needs of individual students, but when you have 100 kids, like a high school teacher may have, as opposed to 20 kids, it's harder to differentiate to the needs of individual kids. So the bottom line is this. Teachers want to do a great job. They go into this to do a great job. They really want to work with kids, but they need to be really understand their content, they need to understand pedagogy, and they need to love kids. But they need to be treated fairly because they can't do it alone.
Well, we've just been talking to Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. Our topic today was reforming teacher tenure. We have a website, examiningeducation.org, where you can listen to past programs, find out more about our speakers, follow links to other websites with more details about issues raised in our discussions, and where you could send us your suggestions and comments. You can also find us on Facebook, Examining Education. Our managing editor is Jason Croft. We had audio support from Mike Pritchard. I'm your host and producer, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley.